We're not going to sing.
Desperado. No, we're not. I won't tell you what mechanism we got this information from, but the people we got it from was my wife, Pat.
And my wife, Joy.
Who were just in tears about the beautiful flowers that this group of people sent them to take our place. And we're very, very grateful. You guys are the most thoughtful to do that. What did your, you know...
She said, can you go back there soon? Not really. She just says, they were beautiful and thank you.
He left in the, you know, kind of unscheduled, and he said to his wife before he left, I'm sorry that, I'm going to take off again. And she said, well, I'm glad you're getting to do this, but sometime I want to go too, where, you know. And Pat kind of felt the same way, and today they both were very grateful to have their flowers there and their husbands here. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't have a watch, and I would love it if somebody that has a watch that I could actually see would bring it up, and I'll try to be done here before lunch. That's perfect, man. Thank you. Now I've got to calculate when I'm finishing here. All right, I did. Now, yesterday I said that I don't get nervous because I have a pretty good idea what I'm going to say, and you have no idea what you're going to hear. So the only one here should be nervous should be you and not me. Today it's a little different. And it's not that I'm nervous, but I'm in the exact same position as you are. Because I have no idea what I'm going to say. And that's not usually the case with me, but the reason that that is because of the short notice. And, you know, I'm going to kind of finish part of the story that I wasn't able to finish yesterday. And that was that library that I told you about that Bill and Arbutus had down in Texas. After Bill had died, Arbutus had some health issues, and they needed some way to help pay for that. And make a real long story short, I ended up purchasing that library. So that I brought it home, and there's 3,500 reel-to-reel tapes in this library, and just boxes and boxes of archives. So my wife, who is very agreeable to everything in recovery, which I really, truly appreciate and am really, really blessed to have her in my life. And, you know, she knows that this is my way to do God's work. And she really supports it. And she's a musician. And she plays her flute at church and does, you know, various things with that. And I really support that. So, because I know she's doing God's work and she's just doing it another way. But when I wheeled into the driveway with a U-Haul truck with all of this stuff, I didn't realize I was going to have to refurbish, reconstruct, or modify my home. Because in Arizona, you don't want to put reel-to-reel recordings out in the garage. They won't last long. So we took the living room and we divided it, and I had someone come in and they built a wall. So we could still have the dining area, and then next to it we had the library. So in there I had shelves built, and, you know, that's beautiful. It's a mess, but it's beautiful. I mean, it does exactly what it needs to do. So I have that library, and as a result of that, we came back with the determination that I would get that library digitized, which really means I'm going to take it from the old reel-to-reels, and I'm going to transfer it over onto hard drives so that it's archived properly, and then I would compress those files, and make them available to the AA and Al-Anon community through the internet. And we began that project a couple of years ago. And I know that, you know, I don't normally go to an AA meeting and speak much about this kind of stuff. This particular talk is really my experience with AA history, and it wouldn't be, I wouldn't be effective if I didn't give you a little bit of background about why I have some experience. One of the qualifications that they really asked us to do while we're here is not to give instruction, but to share our experience with whatever the topic was that we decided to talk about. So my topic this morning is really going to be related to AA history because of the countless hundreds and hundreds of hours that I've spent with this library. And I know you're all going to come up to me and say, well, what's the website? So I'm just going to tell you that it's recoveryspeakers.org, and there are, you can download some recordings there, let your sponsees know, and any contributions that you can make are also welcome. And I didn't come here to solicit that, but again, it wouldn't be fair for me to give this particular talk and not mention what I'm doing. You know, that, you know, it says what happened, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And this is what it's like today. Now, I talked about my education briefly yesterday. And I got my undeserved high school diploma, and that's how I kind of went through life until I got my first sales job. And when I got my first sales job, I realized that the company that hired me oversold their training, and because they didn't offer any. So I spent 4 to 6 hours every day training myself how to sell. And I'd get up early in the morning. I was doing what I was taught in AA. I'd get up early in the morning. I was getting the best material I could get to read and listen to. And within 8 weeks, I became one of the top representatives in that company. And within 21 months, I had the highest field position that that company had to offer me. And then I became a sales trainer, and I traveled around and did a lot of workshops and teaching people how to sell. Well, that, you know, that background and that career, you know, gave me a great opportunity to have education that I didn't get in a classroom. And I, you know, and I'm grateful for that, for the education that I received through the experience of the work that I had done over a 20-year period. And it really prepared me for a trip that I made to Myrtle Beach about 3 years ago. Yeah, it's probably a little longer than that. I have a bad time remembering the past as far as years, how long ago it was. But anyway, I was down there speaking at a similar thing as we're doing this weekend, and I had the opportunity to meet with and spend some time with a man down there who's an author and a screenwriter and been involved in that part of the industry. And he and I spent a day together, had a great time. And I was telling him about my library, and, you know, we talked a lot about that, and he was really interested. And before the day ended, he said, you know, we really ought to write a book. And I'm like, oh, that'd be a great idea. I got a lot of ideas for things and stuff. And then I dismissed it and went on about my busy life. You know, why don't we take, I think we've talked about this, but why don't we document some of the historical stories of men and women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that have over 50 years of continuous sobriety and share their experiences and document those as a historical record. And he said, that's a good idea. Let's do that, and we'll call it 500 years of sobriety. Now, here's the salesman in me. I'm like, no, man, let's do 1,000 years of sobriety, okay? 500 is not good enough, you know. And 1,000 years is just 20 men and women, each with over 50 years sober. And he says, well, do you think we can find, you know, 20 men and women? And I want to tell you that one of the saddest things about that experience was that we were only able to pick 20 of the many that are out there in the various communities today with over 50 years sober. I'm so grateful, you know, that we were able to do that. So this was an idea. And then he says to me, well, would you mind if I talk to the publisher and see if they're interested? And I'm like, oh, go ahead, that'd be fine. Then he said, calls me back a while later and says, hey, the publisher's very interested in this. Would you mind if I had my attorney negotiate a contract? That'd be fine. I'm kind of busy anyway. I get a contract in the mail. I sign it and I send it back. They send me a check. Tell me AA doesn't work. I hadn't written a word. Now, I'd love to tell you that when that check arrived, that I greeted that knowing that my life was in divine order unfolding into goodness. That I greeted that with tremendous faith and I trusted that it was all going to be good. That's what 24 plus years of sobriety at the time. That's how I would like to have greeted that check. It's not what happened. What happened was I was afraid. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to do it. See, somewhere along the line back when I was in my drinking times prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I lost the ability to dream. And I no longer had dreams when I came to you. You began to give me my dreams first in the form of the promises in the big book. Then you began to give me my dreams by lifting me up and showing me I could do these things. So I get this contract to do this book. I've never written anything published. The company I worked for published some sales pieces that I did, but nothing that went outside of the company. So I had done that type of writing, but nothing that people were going to read. And I did have some fear about that. You folks taught me what to do when I'm faced with fear. And it was like I said yesterday about the drinking. I got drunk and we get sober. And that's what they taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I don't do any of these things alone. So what I did is I called Howard and I talked to other people. What do you think they said? Well, you'll do fine. Don't worry about it. You know, I just got started on it. And then I would share a little bit with someone or maybe send something to somebody else. And they would call me up and they'd go, that's great. And I trusted then. It was like I needed that feedback from you to just say it's good. Okay? Then, you know, I had the challenge of presenting the work to the people that were writing the stories about, because we did them in first person. So, and we did people who were all living. And then we'd send it to them and open ourselves up for whatever criticism they may want to give or suggestions or whatever it was. And I'm just going to tell it. I mean, I was scared to death of Clancy, okay? I mean, I know some of you know him, but I was. I was just afraid that he wasn't going to approve of his story, and I had the privilege of writing that. And I sent him the manuscript and arranged a call, and I called him, and he said, kid, even Clancy knew what to call me. I don't know where you got this stuff, but you did a darn good job. He might not have used that word. And then we went through it, but you know, he lifted me up. What a great experience. Now I'm sharing that again because the library that I have, that's a historical archive, is what led to this happening. Okay? It began to God began to unfold his plan for me. It was not what I was thinking. It wasn't a direction I was going in. If the economy had stayed good, I probably would have missed this window, this opportunity. But because the economy had dropped, my business had leveled off to a point where I had time that I normally wouldn't have had. And then this opportunity came about. So that book came out in November. In December, I get a phone call from the publisher. And they say, listen, would you be interested, Or would you be able to do a book on the history of Al-Anon? They're getting ready to celebrate their 60th anniversary. And I said, when's their 60th anniversary? And he said, 2011. And this is December, last December. And I said, well, let me think about it. And he said, great, I'll call you tomorrow. So that night I sketched out a little outline. And I prayed about it. I did what I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I shot him an email. And 2 weeks later, we put a contract together to do that book. And they gave me a deadline of March 15th. It was like 10 weeks away. And I said, man, you got to give me more time. He says, well, what do you need? I said, give me April 1st. I'm an optimist, right? So I had just completed that right before Scott called. And again, what we use the library for that was the source material that I was able to document came from the pioneers of that fellowship. So in that document are things that, in that book, are documents and transcriptions of things that no one's ever heard. And a lot of it has to do with our fellowship, because that organization, the Fellowship of Al-Anon, was an outgrowth of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know the details of this. So as I began listening to these old recordings and looking at the letters and studying the files, I started learning about Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, in a way that I never knew. And Ann started a group for the wives in 1936. With Henrietta D., Bill D.'s wife. And there was a lady that I have some letters from named Myrtle. Myrtle L. from Colorado City, Texas. And Myrtle traveled all over. And she interviewed Henrietta D., Bill D.'s wife, at a meeting up in Canada in 1952. And when she interviewed her, she asked Henrietta about the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she wrote all this stuff down. And I was able to share some of that. And some of the things that were interesting about it was this. We often, you know, those of us who study the history, hear a tremendous amount about Dr. Bob being the spiritual alcoholic and Bill Wilson being the whatever we hear about Bill. Okay? The promoter, the womanizer. I'm going to address some of these things from a tremendous amount of research that I've done. But Henrietta D. said this, that Bill W. was over at their house. And this is apparently while Bill D. was still in the hospital. And Bill W. and Henrietta were talking, and Henrietta says to Bill W., Bill Wilson, she says, I'm a Christian, and Bill says, great. And she said, and Bill says, well, have you dealt with your sins? And she said, I don't have any. And Bill said, have you been resentful toward the behavior your husband's had toward you and your son? And she said, yes. And he said, can you see that that is not the type of behavior you want? I don't know if he called that a sin or not, and it wasn't in this document. But she said, yes, I can. And he said, let's get down on our knees and ask God to remove these things from you. And they knelt down in the room and they prayed. And they asked God to remove these sins from Henrietta. And this was Bill Wilson, not Dr. Baum. Henrietta said, nothing happened. She woke up during the night that night. This feeling came over her, and she knew that her husband would never drink again. See, I believe what happened was God answered her prayer, and she had this feeling that she could trust in divine order, that things were okay, that she was with the right people. And I think Bill W.'s message to her was very powerful. And I'm going to jump all over the place because I didn't lay this out and I have note cards or anything. So what you're getting is just whatever pops into my head. Now, we hear the story of Roland Hazard, okay? And Kevin and I were talking about, you know, Roland was from Rhode Island. So the guys from Rhode Island are, they want to like have a shrine to Roland Hazard, man, up there in Rhode Island. Roland Hazard traveled, came from a very wealthy family. He was a bad alcoholic, and I'm going to give you kind of my quick version of it, because there's a few other things I'd like to talk about. But Roland was treated by Carl Jung, Dr. Carl Jung. And in essence, what Carl Jung had said to him is, Roland, I've done everything I can for you. I can't help you. And basically gave him his death sentence, and that was, you're going to die of an alcoholic death. And Roland, I'm sure, felt like I did the last time I went into a hospital for help. And the admissions counselor came out. This was on the 23rd of April of 1985. And the admissions counselor met me in the lobby of the hospital, and he put his hands up and he said, you can't come in here. You've been here too many times. We can't help you. And I felt like the gates of hell were slamming down. And I believe that Roland probably felt the same way when Carl Jung said, the only thing that I know of that can help you, and I don't know how to give it to you, is some sort of spiritual conversion. Roland ended up back in the United States and was given or picked up at some way a book by William James. It was written in 1902 called The Varieties of Religious Experience. I don't know if any of you have ever read it. I recommend it. It's like reading the concepts, you know. I didn't say that. Okay. There's a section in that book on conversion experiences. And one of the conversion experiences, and now, I want to give you a little background. My sponsor was friends with, my original sponsor was friends with a lot of these guys that were living then, and I shared that yesterday, but one of the men that he knew quite well was Shoemaker, Dr. Sam Shoemaker, who by then was in Pittsburgh. But John had known him, and they had opportunities to have conversations about the early days. And one of the stories that Shoemaker had shared with John about the Roland Hazard experience was, Roland got this book, Varieties of Religious Experience, and in there he read the story about the conversion of a man named Samuel Hadley. Okay? Samuel H. Hadley was a horrible drunk who had decided he was going to commit suicide by jumping in the river in New York. Somehow on the way to commit suicide, he ends up getting locked in jail voluntarily so that he can go through the DTs and come out of the alcohol. And he eventually made his way to a mission in New York called the Water Street Mission. And the Water Street Mission was being run by a guy named Jerry McCauley. And Jerry McCauley had a nickname. His nickname was the Apostle to the Drunkard. And Hadley finds his way to Jerry McCauley, and he goes up to the front and he gives his life to Jesus, and he stops drinking. And he spends the next 15 years helping alcoholics at the Water Street Mission. This is 1882. Okay. So James puts this in his book. Roland Hazard reads this, and Roland begins to find hope by reading the story of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Isn't that amazing? It works today the same way as it did then. Roland found some hope. What does Roland do? He looks for the mission. The mission of the time that he was looking for the mission. By the time he was looking, it was around 1933, maybe a little bit earlier, but around that time frame. He ends up at Calvary Mission. Calvary Mission was being run by the Calvary Church, which also had the Calvary House. And the Calvary House was where the Oxford Group was headquartered for the U.S. Okay? And Shoemaker was really the leader, Sam Shoemaker, at that time for the Oxford group. Well, Calvary Mission was an extension of this that was off campus, but down a little bit, and that's where they would put the people, the homeless, the drunks, the people needing food, and, you know, they had a piano up in front, and they had a podium up there so they could give testimony. And, so Roland gets there to the mission. And he walks into the mission, and who's the very first person that greets him at the door? Henry Hadley, the son of Samuel Hadley. Henry Hadley was sober. He got sober on the day after his dad died. So then he never knew, his dad didn't know that he was sober. You know, I didn't share that yesterday. Started talking about my dad, and I usually get real weepy when I do, so I try not to. One of the greatest memories that I have in my experience so far in Alcoholics Anonymous was my dad said, "Hey, Mike, come on, take a ride with me." And he was going over to Fort Erie, Canada. And he was speaking that night at an AA meeting. And we went over. It was a Sunday night. We got to the meeting, and he said, "I'll go first, and then you wrap it up." Now, him and his sponsor, when they used to go speak at meetings together, they would share the meeting. They would each take 20 minutes when they were invited. And they were both named Art. So, you know, you never knew what Art you were going to get. But this particular night, my dad says, I'll start and then you can finish. I had no idea that was going to happen. But when the evening was over and we were greeting the people, I was able to look over at him and know that it was all sewed up. Yeah. It was exactly the way it was supposed to be. Our lives were together because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all the wreckage from the past no longer mattered. It was all right. And I'm just so grateful that I had that opportunity. And I know that Henry Hadley missed that opportunity with his father. I'm grateful I didn't miss it with mine. And it's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, Roland went to the Calvary Mission, and I don't know all the experiences that happened to him, but at the same time, there was a guy, Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby was up in Manchester, Vermont, literally drinking himself to death. And I'm not going to give you Ebby's whole story, but I do want to share a few details that are not real common about Ebby's story. And Ebby was, he lived in a family house that his parents had bought. They were both deceased. His family was pretty well sick of him. He had spent his inheritance, and he literally was drinking himself to death. Shep Cornell and Zebra Graves, two guys that were also members of the Oxford group that knew Ebby, went up to Manchester to see Ebby. And they stopped by his house. It was late in the summertime of 1934. And they talked to Ebby, and of course Ebby was drinking, and they were sober. And they talked to Ebby about the Oxford group and how they were sober in the Oxford group. And Ebby knew that they were drinkers, but he knew they weren't alcoholic like him. I mean, you know, there's people I drank with that I knew were drinkers, but I knew they weren't like me, man, you know. And I think Ebby felt that way. And he said, "I knew they were heavy drinkers, but they weren't alcoholic like me." But Ebby liked what they had to share. They talked to Ebby about what they were learning and what they were doing in the Oxford group, and they gave him some ideas. And one of the ideas that they gave him was about having a God of his understanding that he could pray to. Okay, and that they were going out and they were doing these good works. And Ebby listened to them, and he was very intrigued by what he was learning from Shep and Zebra. They left. He calls his brother and gets permission to paint the house. So he starts painting the house, and while he was busy, he didn't have a desire to drink. And he remembered what these guys said, and he ran into a little problem there with the ladder wouldn't go up high enough. So he had to get the local painter to come in and help him. And, you know, they finally got the job done, and Ebby went back to drinking. being busy helped him. And when he didn't have something to do, he picked up a drink. Well, in his drunken insanity, he forgot that the town constable was interested in arresting him. So he made it to town, and the constable picked him up, and he brought Abby to the judge in Manchester. And the judge was Judge Graves, which happened to be Seber Graves' father. What I'm going to explain to you in a few minutes is one of the things Howard said to me was that if you look back through the circumstances and events of your life, you can see how God has pulled a golden thread through those events that have got you to where you are today. I want you to see the golden thread that God pulled through the circumstances and events that brought us to where we are today in Alcoholics Anonymous, and why the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is so absolutely important for us to share with each other and talk about and learn and share with our newcomers so that they understand that this program didn't just happen. So Abby goes in front of the judge that day, and the judge says, "Abby, it's Friday afternoon, and I've got an appointment. I want you in my courtroom on Monday morning. I want you to be sober." So the constable takes Abby back to his house, and when he's dropping Abby off, he says, "Abby, I'm going to pick you up Monday morning. I want you to do what the judge said, and I want you to be sober." Well, Abby knew that that didn't mean he was supposed to stop drinking it 7:30 Monday morning. He knew what the judge meant, and that was he wasn't supposed to drink. But Abby had 6 bottles of Ballantine Ale in the basement. And he said he went down there and he looked at that beer, and then he walked up those cellar steps. Then he walked back down. Then he walked back up. He was driving himself crazy because he could not get the obsession of this alcohol out of his mind. And finally, he went down and he grabbed those bottles of beer and he put them in a brown paper bag and he brought them over to the neighbors and he said, "Here, have them." And he made it through that weekend and he got back to that courtroom on Monday morning. And on Monday morning, Seabra was there and Shep was there and they had brought a friend of theirs with him and his name was Roland Hazard. Now, Roland, coming from an affluent family, probably had an in with the judge, even though Seber was the son. I have a feeling that Roland had more influence over that judge than his own son did. And Roland said, "Let me take Abby. We can get him involved in the Oxford group. We can help this man." And the judge said, "Fine, go ahead. I don't want you back in my courtroom, Abby." And over the next couple of weeks, Roland took Abby all over New England, and they spoke at Oxford Group what they called house parties. And that was, you know, like small AA, open AA meetings where anybody would talk. Okay? And they would go in and they would give their story and their pitch to people, and they would say, "Hey, you know, you don't have to live the life you're living today. You can live a different life, and here are the principles that we go by." And they would share these principles of the Oxford Group with these people. Some of them were alcoholics and some of them weren't. Some of them were cheating on their spouse. And some were cheating on their businesses. And some of them had sex problems. And some of them had legal problems. Some of them had problems with their children. There were normal people that were getting together, and it was an open society, okay? It was a non-denominational fellowship that was saying, "We are life changers." And that's what they were trying to be, change one life at a time. And Abby said his first weekend, he's out talking in town halls. I mean, he hadn't been sober for, you know, 3 days, and they got him standing up in front of people giving testimony. Well, Abby did this for a few weeks, and he was invited to New York, and he stayed at Seber Graves' house in New York. He had a townhouse of some kind on Fifth Avenue. I think he probably had a little bit of money. And Seber made it possible for Abby to move into Calvary Mission, same place that Roland had gone to visit. And Abby moved in there, and he stayed there, you know, for a while till he moved in with Bill Wilson. But while Abby was there, he was trying to follow the practices that he was learning in the Oxford group. And by design, I'm not going through the principles of the Oxford group and the absolutes and things we do today, because I hope that when I'm done, that I've stimulated enough interest in some of these things that you'll go on your own and you'll begin to study and research some of this material, because it is fascinating. But Ebby was learning this, and one of the things that they did was they went out to try to pay restitution for the wrong that they did. They tried to make right the wrongs. Kind of sounds like our 8 and 9 step. And he was on Wall Street, and he was seeing some of the people and making some of the amends, and while he was there, he heard about Bill W. and Bill's problem and what was going on and the seriousness of this. And Ebby did know Bill, but I know that some of you have heard that Ebby and Bill were like drinking buddies. Ebby got drunk with Bill one time. This is Ebby's words now, okay? One time. And that particular time was a good drunk, though. Bill came to Albany, and Ebby was living in Albany. He was actually... I think he may have been working in the foundry at that time. His father had a metal business. And anyway, Bill came, and Ebby had done a little bit of stuff on Wall Street, or in the same business, okay? Not on Wall Street, but there in Albany. And while Bill was there, he called Ebby, and he did know him. They had known each other from school. As a matter of fact, when they were in school together, this would be equal to early high school, okay? Neither of them had yet experienced drinking, okay? And they both talked about drinking because both of their families had alcoholism in their family, and they both knew that they shouldn't do it. And Ebby, was like, Bill wasn't going to drink, and I wasn't going to drink. Well, then, their lives unfolded, and alcoholism affected both of them in similar ways, but they had both taken two entirely different directions. Well, here they are in Albany, and they hook up, and they go out, and they do a little partying at the bar. Well, they party a little more, and Ebby was hanging around with some guys. Scott will appreciate this, the Flyers, okay? And these guys were barnstormers. And they were like acrobatic, right, with aircraft, okay? And they would entertain people. And Ebby was hanging around with these guys, and they go over to this guy's name, Burke. I can't remember his first name, maybe Ed, but Ebby brings him over there, and they party, and they decide that they want to, instead of taking a train back to Manchester, they would get Ted to fly them. So they arrange for this to happen, and he says, when the sun comes up, we'll go. Well, they drink all night. So somehow they called ahead to Manchester that this was happening. I think the reason they had to call ahead was because it was a brand new airfield. Not a plane had landed there yet. And it was literally a field. It wasn't a runway, The town band comes out. The mayor. The community gathers for this event. Bill and Ebby are trashed. They don't walk off the airplane. They fall off the airplane to an embarrassment of everyone. That was the inaugural flight to Manchester Airport. Now, I can so identify with these comical experiences, that these guys had. Well, Ebby found out that Bill was in dire straits. And he knew that he knew he wanted to talk to Bill because he knew he had an answer. He knew he had an answer because it was working for him. But he also knew Bill well enough that he felt he only had one shot at Bill. And he wanted to make it a good one. So he waited a little while, and he thought about this, and finally, he probably got his approach down, kind of like that's the salesman in me. I'd visualize the call I was going to make, and I would see that before I would make it. And I would see all the goodness that was happening from that. Thanks, guys, for all that, because you gave me that ability. And I'm sure Ebby was seeing some of that day. And he picked up the phone, and he called the Wilson house. Now, this is Ebby's version of what happened. Now, I think I said yesterday about my story, you could get a version from my mother, same story, different version. You can get a version from my brother, same story, different version. This is Ebby's version of what happened. He called over to the Wilson house. Lois answered. He told Lois of his circumstances. He was in New York. He was sober. He had never been to New York and been sober at the same time. He talked to her about the Oxford group and what he had found. And he said he believed he had the answer for Bill and he'd like to come by and talk to Bill about it. Lois, of course, was excited and said, Ebby, I'd love for you to come by. And they scheduled a time when Ebby could come by for dinner. Ebby showed up early for dinner at the given night that they had this appointment. And he gets there early and there's no one home except for one of the staff workers for Lois's family. This guy's name was Greens and he was a driver for Lois's parents. And Greens met Ebby at the door and said, come on in and helped Ebby be at home. And then a little while later, Bill shows up and Bill had been drinking. And he said, Bill wasn't bad drunk, but he had been drinking and I knew that. And we had a little small talk and we visited a little bit and Bill's looking at his watch and he needs to go out and get a pack of cigarettes and Bill leaves for a little while and Ebby knows what's going on and Bill comes back and they talk a little bit and Lois hadn't gotten there yet and then, Bill's got to leave again. He wants to pick up some dessert or something for dinner or something. And he leaves and comes back a little while. And Ebby knows Bill's going out for a drink. Well, then Lois shows up and they have their dinner. And they go upstairs into the sitting room where that's where they would entertain people at their home on Clinton Street when they had people to entertain. By that point in the Wilsons' life, there was no entertaining going on. Okay, Bill was in the darkest, deepest throes of alcoholism he had ever been. He had already been in Towns Hospital twice. Okay? He was at the end of the rope. They weren't entertaining, but Ebby came over and they sat in the den and they visited and there was Lois and a girl that was renting a room from the Wilsons upstairs and Ebby and Bill. And they were having some small talk and finally Lois says to Ebby, what's been going on with you? Tell us what's been happening. And this is about 7 o'clock in the evening and Ebby said he finished around 1. And he talked for 4 hours and I can just see Ebby giving Bill the most enthusiastic pitch he could possibly give because he was dealing with a man that had some experience in giving enthusiastic pitches. And he knew this had to have depth and weight. And he knew this had to be enough to move Bill in a direction or Bill would slam the door and die. And Ebby knew that. And Ebby talked to him and he gave him his pitch. And then Bill decides he's going to walk Ebby to the subway that night. And on the way to the subway, he puts his arm around Ebby. And he says, Eb, I don't know what you got, but I want it. Now that's Ebby's version of the kitchen table story. It looks a little different than what we read in the big book. Now, I don't know which version is exactly true, but Ebby was sober and Bill was drunk. Now, you all know shortly after that, I'm going to skip around because there's some things that I want to address and I don't want you to think that I was invited here to give you Mike's agenda because anything that I share, and I really wish I would have said this yesterday, anything that I share is my opinion of this program and my opinion of the interpretation and the gifts that have been given to me in the program. I do not speak as an authority on AA or alcoholism or the disease or the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. No one has the authority to do that. Okay? I am no different than the newest member here today. I'm going to talk a little bit about that this afternoon when I share some things on the traditions. But in saying that, I have had the opportunity to be around some people who have taken the time to teach me and spend an enormous, and I shared that about John. And again, the golden thread. Well, when Joy and I got married in 1987, I had told you she was a school teacher in Michigan. And we decided to get married in December instead of after the school year ended, which was what the original plan was. So how it unfolded was I would move to Michigan until she was done teaching, and then we would move to Arizona together at the end of that school year, which is what we did. So there was really no sense in me getting a job when I moved to Michigan. She was working. We had a little apartment, and we're going to move anyway. So I went to AA meetings, and a lot of AA meetings. I met some guys at one of the groups, and they knew I was excited, you know, and passionate about the history. And they said, hey, we want to introduce you to a friend of ours. And they brought me to this lady's house. And we go up these stairs to this little condo on a lake and this apartment. And this lady is wearing this long dress and kind of her hair's up, and she kind of looked like Ann Smith in any pictures I'd seen of Ann Smith. And her name was Ruth G. And I'm not, you know, I'm real careful about anonymity from the podium. And I know I've shared some last names today, but most of the last names that I share are historical in the sense that they've already been shared. And they really are public domain. So anything other than that, I don't even give my last name from the podium anymore, because by the time I get home, somebody will tell me, I really like that talk that you gave the other night in Tennessee, because they'll already be listening to it on the internet. So I'm real careful about giving last names and sharing that. But Ruth came out that day and she says, hi, Mike. My husband and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Dr. Bob's house. I'm like, really? Are you an alcoholic, Ruth? She says, no, Ernie was the alcoholic. But they treated us the same. I was included in everything. And she got my attention. Her husband was AA number 78. Okay. Now, that AA number 78 is not real significant to you, but I'm going to tell you when he came into the program, and then maybe you'll see some significance. The big book, the first printing of the first edition big book, came out in April of 1939. Ernie came into AA in May of 1939, and he was AA number 78. We now are 100 men and women who have recovered, which was written a year earlier. It was just reporting the facts before they happened. That's all right, you know. That's what I used to do when people say, how you doing? I'm doing good. I knew it was going to happen eventually. So Ernie was number 78, and Ruth said to me, you know, we visited, and she was telling me about the meetings that they had at Dr. Bob's home, and the times that they went camping with Dr. Bob and Ann Smith, and the meetings at T. Henry and Clarice Williams' house in Akron, where they would go to meetings of the Oxford group. And when I left that day, she said, Mike, you come back and see me anytime. So I made a date with her to come back the next Friday, and every Friday thereafter while I was there, I went and saw Ruth. She would prepare for my visits by typing up or writing out affirmations and then cutting them out for me. And I would get there and she'd give me these little crosses that she stitched up somehow. And she would give me those. I still have them somewhere. And then she'd also give me these affirmations. And these were her way of teaching, you know, her way of doing what she had learned and carrying the message that she learned. And we talked a lot about early AA members. And again, God pulling a golden thread through the circumstances and events that brought me to where I am today. Okay? I don't know why Ruth was in my life. I have no idea why that happened. I didn't know I'd be writing books about the history. I had no idea I'd own that library. I'm listening to my buddy Tom Ivester a few years ago, and Tom says that we seem to gravitate toward the area of Alcoholics Anonymous that we came into Alcoholics Anonymous in, kind of the direction or the place that we're introduced. It clicked, and I realized, no wonder you're so interested in this. No wonder your kids are wondering why their house is a museum. No wonder, you know, it's funny, in my garage, I have so many books, I had to have them out in the garage. And I had these shelves out there, and I don't, you know, I mean, I don't apologize to anybody for being an alcoholic. You come to my house, and, you know, if you're clergy, or you're a friend of the kids, or a parent, or whatever, there's AA books laying on the table. That's just the way it is. And there was probably 300 third edition big books in my garage, okay? Just, it's obsessive, okay? So, anyway. So my daughter tells me this story, and she is just great. She goes out, and her and her girlfriend are leaving, okay? So they're in the garage, and they click the garage door opener, and they're backing out. I usually have everything kind of tarped off so the dust won't get at this kind of stuff. Well, this day the tarp was down. I was probably looking for something. And the girl with my daughter looks and says, "Wow, you got a lot of books." Emily says, "Oh, yeah, that's my dad." And she says, "Are those all the same?" Emily says, "You got to know my dad." I don't know why I said that, but what the heck. All right. I you're going to hear a lot about Bill Wilson today. You're going to hear a lot about Bill Wilson because Bill Wilson was the architect that put this program together. Bill Wilson is the one that wrote the big book. Bill Wilson wrote the 12 and 12. Bill Wilson designed our service structure. Bill Wilson wrote our traditions. During Bill's life, he suffered with depression. And his depression was quite serious. It wasn't always a debilitating depression, but it certainly was a challenge in Bill's life. I thank God that Bill had the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous because he was able to work through his depression. And during some of the darkest depressions that Bill ever had, he did some of his greatest work. Our third legacy, which I'm going to talk about this afternoon, Bill crafted during some of the darkest depressions that he ever had. My sponsor, Big John's sponsor, was sponsored by Bill. And John was privileged to get to hang around with Bill on very informal occasions. And I would sit with John, and as I shared yesterday, till the wee hours of the morning, and we would talk, and one of John's favorite topics was to tell me stories of Bill W. And he would tell me, he said, one night they're in Dallas. And he said, we're in a hotel room in Dallas, and Dick, his sponsor, says to John, "John, I think I'm going to try to get Bill to tell you boys about when he wrote the 12 steps." And John said they're sitting there that evening, just casually drinking some coffee. The events had winded down. He said Bill always wore a tie. And he said he had his long legs, and he's sitting on the chair in the hotel, and there's a little footstool, and he's got his feet stretched out. And John was a storyteller. He loved to tell stories. And he said, Bill loosened his tie, and Dick looked over and said, "Bill, would you mind telling the boys about when you wrote the 12 steps?" And Bill gets comfortable and looks, and he says, "Well," and I'm paraphrasing this, I'll try to be as close to accurate as I can. I actually have this all documented. I went to one of the international conventions, and a guy that had heard of me, you know, met me there, and he said, John Carlton was your sponsor, wasn't he?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I got something I want to give you." And he came up and he gave me, I showed Howard, a transcription of what I'm about to share with you of the night in a hotel room in Dallas when Dick said, "Bill, can you tell the boys about writing the 12 steps?" And Bill said he was taking a nap this day, and he woke up, and he went over by the window, and he was looking out the window, and he had his desk there. And there was a pad there and a pencil. And he said he looked out the window, and it was foggy. And he could see the fog, and somehow in the fog, he saw a silhouette. And it was as if it was a vision of a woman, kind of maybe a religious woman, and this was Bill's words. And he said, I looked, and he said, I'm not sure what that was, and I picked up that pencil. He said, I didn't pick up the pencil. The pencil moved into my hand. And I started writing, and I wrote one, and I wrote, and two, and I wrote. And he said, now I know I wasn't imagining this. When I got to 12, that pencil hit the desk, and I knew I was done. And boy, that's how the 12 steps were written. Now that was Bill telling John and these guys in a hotel room. I'm sitting at the edge of my seat. Okay? See, this stuff was interesting to me. And I would ask questions. And I began to ask questions because I started hearing rumors. And I would say things to John. Well, what was this Bill? You know, I heard that it was a womanizer. And John said, no truth to that, Mike. And I said, really? He said, no truth to that. He said, let me tell you something. He said, we got to be around Bill at the meetings, and we went to the meetings with Bill. Bill was a gentleman, and Bill loved his wife dearly. And Bill was always a fine example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he was out in public, he knew he was being watched by people. Bill was a leader that had a strong and powerful charisma about him. And when he was there, there may be reporters there ready to try to bring down AA. He said, you know, it wasn't all good press. He said there were people there trying to find things wrong with Bill W. and his character in Alcoholics Anonymous because they would have loved to have been the one to crack the big story. And he said, but nobody ever had a big story to crack because there wasn't one. He said, he told me a funny story, though. He says, one day Bill told the story of being at a clubhouse in New York, probably the 24th Street Clubhouse, which was one of Bill's favorite places to hang out. And he said, he's talking to some newcomer, and he's having a conversation. The guy comes up and says, Bill, I need to talk to you. And Bill's like, just a minute. And he's carrying on. He's into this conversation. And the guy comes back, Bill. And finally, Bill's, you know, exasperated and says, what? And the guy says, Mickey's out in the back with some girl in the back seat of the car. And Bill says, are they drinking? It was very clear that the traditions, when I talk about the traditions, it was very clear that the traditions came out of the experiences, okay? Bill knew the single purpose. Bill's business wasn't what the heck somebody was doing in a car. Bill knew that his business was talking to that newcomer who was in that meeting. That was his business, and that's where he stayed. After Bill died in 1971, not long after that, publications started to appear about his character. And people saying things like he was a womanizer. And books being written. There's one, I gave it to Howard recently. It's on sex addiction. And they have a whole chapter dedicated to Bill Wilson. I will guarantee you that not one bit of that is true. It's just not. Now, was he a man? Sure he was. You know, did he ever flirt with someone? I don't know. Maybe. You know, I occasionally do that. I hope if I give some girl a hug in the meeting, they're not calling my wife saying, hey, your husband's having an affair. I don't see that. I don't see that in Bill. I've had the privilege of going through many, many, many documents in Stepping Stones, the home of Bill and Lois Wilson. And I do want to tell you that if you have an opportunity to visit Stepping Stones or to support them, go to their website, see what you can do to help them. They are doing some incredible work for our fellowship by keeping the history alive for all of us and making it available to anyone who wants it and needs it. And I am so grateful that they're doing that because unfortunately some other archives aren't making it available nearly as readily as Stepping Stones is to the historians and people who are interested in that. But going through these archives and seeing these things, I've had the privilege of seeing the exact same documents that the people who have done some of the writing that have been negative about Bill have used as their credible resources to validate what they've written. I've looked at the same documents and yet have come up with an entirely different theory. There was a woman named Helen W., who was very close to Bill, and in the late 1950s, through some research with a chemical called Leuco, and then one called niacin, Bill and Helen began to work together on some test studies with Dr. Hoffer in Saskatchewan and another doctor partner of his that were dealing with niacin to treat schizophrenia and alcoholism. And they were taking massive amounts of this, and Bill, as an experiment, had put a small group of about 30 people together that were suffering from what he called unhappy sobriety. Okay? And what this was a group of people with 10 years or more of AA that for some reason were not experiencing what some other people were able to experience by the 12 steps directly. So they were trying to find the balance through the chemicals. Now, some of you heard about the LSD experiments that Bill was involved in, and I don't want to share any of that information at this talk, so I'm just letting you know this stuff was niacin, it is vitamin B3, I take it today. A lot of people take it. They now prescribe it for cholesterol. Maybe Bill was really on the cutting edge of some of this stuff. I'm certain that he was with the depression. He found that the massive doses of niacin was actually helping to level him off. And over the last 10 years of his life, he really had no depression. Helen was involved in the test studies with Bill. She was an editor for the Grapevine, and Bill wrote two documents, in detail on the studies that they had been doing, and Helen was the one who edited and typed them up. Bill didn't want to bring his work to the General Service Office because it was not AA related. Bill was a guy who really followed the traditions of our program. Because it was not AA related, they used Helen's apartment. This was the last 10 years of this man's life. He was not chasing this woman around the table. He was there to do something to be of service so he could help the alcoholics who weren't able to get the full effects of sobriety because of their depressions and other problems that they had. While Bill was dying, Helen and their relationship was such, she would go over to his home at Stepping Stones and administer the niacin to Bill. Bill left Helen some money in her will, in his will. That's one of the points that they bring up as this affair that he allegedly had with Helen. They say it's because he left her money in the will. Why else would he leave her money in the will if he wasn't having an affair? Well, maybe he left her money in the will because he wanted her to continue to have the resources to do the work that they were already working on. I believe that that's why. And I don't think that's going to sell books by making Bill W. a sex addict, but I think that it's something that needs to be told. So I'm telling you. You know, it's unfortunate that a lot of these allegations never happened when Bill could defend himself. So maybe it takes some of us to defend him. I know this, when I'm out with somebody and they're telling me about Bill W. and his character, I was in a meeting. Man, this was a traditions meeting. I'm going to qualify this too. I want you to know something. When I'm in a meeting and I meditate every day, okay? Thanks to Howard's encouragement, and it's become a discipline. It's become a daily discipline. And it probably has brought me, it has without question given me the greatest opportunity to increase a relationship with a loving God that I have ever had. Because that's where that relationship develops, is in that meditation. I get to go within. And give me a minute, I lost where I was at. Ah, tradition. I'm in a meeting. Okay. Here's what I wanted to say. One thing is this. I would sit in meetings and somebody would say something that I didn't like. And I'd go home and I'd be like irritated and frustrated and angry, and I want to correct them, and I want to say, man, I wish you wouldn't do that. I wish you wouldn't get in that newcomer's face and tell them they're going to get drunk if they don't do it your way. And I just wish you wouldn't do that, because I'm not so sure that you're correct. You know, maybe what they're doing is exactly what they need to do. Maybe their life is unfolding in divine order and God's pulling a golden thread through their life. I believe that He is. But I was also humbled at about 5 years sober, because I thought it was my responsibility to tell people what they were doing wrong. You don't make a whole lot of friends when you do that, man, you know. It's like, they don't care how much big book you know. You start telling them they're not doing it right, they don't want to be around you. So I worked on that. And how I worked on it is in meditation one day. I was kind of hung up over an issue I was having with a guy. And it occurred to me that it was all right with the God of my understanding that that person was where they were at on their spiritual journey. And I asked it myself in a question, and it was, Mike, is it all right with God that that person's where they're at on their journey? Because God's not done with them yet. And I thought, well, yes. Then my head asked me another question. Then why are you playing God? And I had to allow myself to accept wherever they were at on their spiritual journey if I was going to not play God. And the book that I read tells me that I have to stop doing that. And it's okay that they're where they're at on their journey. And I'm in this traditions meeting one night, and it's on tradition 7. And this girl says, well, we probably wouldn't have needed so much money if Bill Wilson was such a thieving bastard. I wanted to go home and meditate. I'm probably going to tell that story this afternoon, but I want you to know that understanding the traditions and understanding the history gives us an advantage when we hear something that's not true, because we can dismiss it and we might be able to help someone else have a better understanding of the truth. And if we can do that, then I think we're lifting the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous up, and not just the individual. We're lifting the entire movement of Alcoholics Anonymous up by us having a greater understanding of what has happened and what has taken place. This fellowship is only 75 years old, and we right now are the ones that are laying the history of this fellowship. See, the history of this movement is put in our hands. And I believe today it's in good hands. And that's something else I want to talk about. I've heard the prophets of doom. And they want to come to my group and your group and tell us we're not doing it right. Then we need to go back to some time when AA worked better. We need to get back to when this deal really worked right. What they're implying is that it's not working today right. I've studied the history. I'd like to know when it is they'd like us to go back to. 1935, they had 2 members. In the fall of 1938, Bill W. is down in Akron, Ohio. They're sitting in Dr. Bob's living room and they're counting heads. They want to know how many successful people they had in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we already know that there was some tendency to exaggerate some of this. In the fall of 1938, they came up with 40 names of people that they thought were sober. 40. I hope that's not the time they want us to go back to. Because let me tell you what happened from 1935 to 1940. Bill Wilson was given permission to go into the leading hospital of narcotic and alcohol addiction in this country, and that was Towns Hospital, and he was the first lay person ever given permission to deal directly with the patients, and he was able to take those patients and bring them to his home and work with them to try to get those alcoholics sober, and he dealt with a lot of them. And Dr. Bob went to Akron City Hospital, and he was a physician, and he was given the same privilege and opportunity. And Bill Dodson was an attorney and well respected in his community, and he went out and he found every drunk he could and he tried to help them because they knew they had to carry the message, because if they didn't, they would drink, and they knew it, and they talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and in 1938, after all that work, they had 40 people sober. Are we going to go back to those times? I don't want to go back to those times. I don't know about you. Now, I know I've seen my dad and his sponsor go get people out of court, my mother make meals and help these guys, okay? And bring them to meetings. But you know, they worked so hard. Our pioneers worked so hard to stay sober, to carry this message even before that book was written, to reach out to one alcoholic and say, hey, there's hope for you. Come to our home. And they opened their homes up. And these guys sat down with them and they drank coffee till late in the evening and they talked about it. You know, Abby lived with Bill. He moved in and built. And you know, you hear, oh, Abby got drunk. Well, yes, he did. But let me tell you something. Huh? Here's something we don't hear. Abby got sober in August or September of 1934. Bill got sober in December of 1934. Dr. Bob got sober in June of 1935. So they had 6 months, thereabouts. Well, Bill's in Akron, Ebby's living at his house. When Bill came back, Ebby stayed there, and Bill would stay up at night with Ebby, and they would talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't yet have a name, but they were talking about the principles that became the program, just as Bill and Dr. Bob did. Ebby continued to try to help the drunks in New York. They were moving them into Bill's house. They were working with them. Bill did the same thing. Dr. Bob was doing the same thing, and Ebby stayed sober for a couple of years, 27 months. See, we don't hear about that. Ebby was sober in the early days of AA, and he was living with Bill. I believe that when Bill later always referred to Ebby as his sponsor, he did that because Ebby was his sponsor. I don't think that was, well, I need to be nice to Ebby because he helped lead me to this promised land. I think Bill gave Ebby the credit for being a sponsor because they had that relationship that they had developed in Bill's home when Ebby lived there. And yes, Ebby didn't have continuous sobriety. And he got drunk and he wandered New York and he tried to get sober and things happened. And in like 1950, it was like 53, I could look at my notes and give you exact dates, but Ebby was floundering around in New York, and I'm going to wrap it up with this story. And a guy from New York was over in Paris, France. And he attended an AA meeting while he was in Paris. And while he was there, a guy came up to him and said, you're from New York? And he said, yep. How's my buddy Ebby doing? And he says, I don't know Ebby, but all the news I've heard isn't good. And this guy said, gee, I'd really like to see Ebby get sober. If you can find Ebby, would you make it possible, and I'll pay for it, but would you make it so that Ebby can get down to Texas? Because this guy that he was talking to had gotten sober in Texas, and he was attracted to him. And he said, could you get Ebby hooked up with those folks in Texas? And the guy said, I'd love to. So the guy got back to New York, and he called the intergroup office, and he said, listen, if Ebby shows up, will you get a hold of me? And he did. Hazel called this man one afternoon, and they made arrangements for Ebby to come in there, and then And then this guy took Ebby and got him a hotel room and a bottle and a meal and this. And Ebby ended up going to Texas and getting sober. And he stayed that way for a good part of the rest of his life, you know. And he did a lot of great things for the people in Texas. He died in 1966, right around this time, in the beginning of April. Matter of fact, I think 2 days ago, I think it was April 6th. And Ebby carried the message to Bill. I always look at Ebby as the messenger. But the man that was in Paris that said I'd like to help Ebby was Seabird Graves. That golden thread. Thank you.